You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
All right, welcome. As I told you earlier, and this is a great time to reflect, a couple weeks ago we did the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council's ethics code, and we talk about, you know, being a sensible fisherman, take what you want and feed your friends and neighbors, but don't waste it and don't do this, and certainly don't break the rules. Out of season, undersized, and all that kind of stuff. And it is very, very frustrating for many that are rules followers, that see others doing it and don't quite know what they should do about it, whether they should rat out their friends or whether they should, you know, take down a license plate of somebody doing something illegal, all the true is above. One of our regular guests on the program, another one of our folks from the council, is Eric Kingma. Eric is in charge of international fisheries and enforcement. And this is a really important issue because if you have a rule that's not getting enforced, what's the point of having the rule? And if you are a rule follower and you see others breaking the rules, what's the point of you following it if there are no consequences? I'm not saying that necessarily the consequence, Eric, should always be a firing squad. But, you know, you have to, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. How did you originally get interested in this area of, number one, international fisheries, and number two, the all-important thing we're going to discuss today, and that's enforcement of rules?
Yeah. Aloha, Uncle Mike. Thanks for having me. We're talking about enforcement today, and how I became involved in enforcement for the Fishery Council was essentially before my position at the council. I worked sort of intern, graduate school student at the U.S. Coast Guard here in Honolulu, the District 14 office, and I worked for the Office of Law Enforcement. And so it's sort of carried over into my role, my position at the council. But that the U.S. Coast Guard has a presence in Hawaii, quite a big one, in Honolulu Harbor. And they have units that have patrol vessels, cutters, helicopters, planes. Mm. And then they have a whole district office at the federal building, too.
And you know what's kind of cool about it? They call everything assets, right?
Assets.
Doesn't matter if you're a truck or a human or a gun, you're an asset.
You're an asset. Right? It's interesting, yeah.
But you know, not only is the 14th district the largest of the districts, covering the most miles, but I think that people must have been surprised, right, when you first told them when you were first there before, what do you mean they chase fishermen? I mean, you know, that's not Coast Guard.
Yeah. That's only one aspect of their sort of responsibility, their mission, and they have a lot going on. The Coast Guard has several missions related to immigration and drug interdiction, and hopefully we can get some Coast Guard personnel on the show to provide some more information, but they are heavily spread out across the U.S. and also in the region. So the Western Pacific region, as we call it, is 1.5 million square miles.
Jeez, I can't even count that
and,
high.
You know, that's our U.S. exclusive economic zone. But when you add in the high seas, it's even larger. So they have an area to patrol and also, you know, search and rescue if a mariner goes down, you know, vessels in distress. They got to go out and look for that vessel. But they also coordinate in certain areas of the Pacific with New Zealand and Australia.
You know, I tell you one thing, and this happens a lot to me, and I push this thing almost every week. You can get this little fluorescent orange sticker that you put on your paddle or on your kayak or on your surf ski or on your stand-up board or whatever. It says, and it has your phone number on it. And when Eric is talking about an asset, there have been so many times when somebody will see a vessel or something floating around, and it'll send up the alarm, the alert, and there will be people and assets deployed to go look at something that might not be an emergency. That must really fry them when that happens.
It does, and it costs a lot of money.
Lot of money.
A C-130, to my understanding, is about $10,000 an hour.
Don't even start it unless it's. But see, here's the deal. It's more than just the money. It's that now this asset is over there, and somebody's in trouble over there, you know, somebody not labeling a paddleboard might cost somebody else their life. That's very scary.
Yeah, and we've gotten calls about all sorts of things, trying to verify if it's a vessel or, you know, it's a fad or something. So it is important to have everything properly marked.
Okay, so now this is a totally voluntary program, and there's no record keeping. You're not registering. Nobody's looking at you, nothing. It's just you stick it on it, and if it gets found, somebody will call it, and you'll say, oh, yeah. it blew off the back of my truck. I didn't realize it was gone. That's happened, isn't it? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So. There's reports of kayaks, you know, floating away. Yeah. And
every week.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's just sort of an aside. That's really not something that is, you're not breaking the law, but you're just being foolish if you don't take responsibility. But I guess what I was saying in the form of an introduction, Eric, is that, you know, rules are only as good as the enforcement. And sometimes enforcement is only as good as the consequences are. So once again, explain how you got out of into that area and then now looking at this on the bigger picture, particularly in international waters.
Yeah. So enforcement is a critical sort of aspect of fisheries management. Mm-hmm. And, you know, human nature is such where, yeah. you know, if there's a rule, you know, there's humans out there, people out there that might want to skirt the rule or bend it or mm-hmm. flat out violate for their own interests. And mm-hmm. so fisheries, like other regulated sort of activities, involve enforcement, and it can be heavy-handed at times mm-hmm. because of the consequences of fishing in some regards.
I do know that the threat for most of us is if you break a rule, they're likely to take your boat or your nets or your spears or your truck or whatever. I mean, in other words, I think rather than being mean to you, I think what they're really doing is setting an example, saying, look, is that lobster out of season worth this hassle?
Yeah. So they want to deter repeat offenders mm-hmm. or deter others that may break the law. And that's why they have, you know, penalty schedules mm-hmm. and the penalties are supposed to fit the violation.
Yeah.
So on a federal violation, let's say you broke a regulation of our rules, say the mm-hmm. council's rules under our fishery management plans that are in federal regulations, the National Marine Fisheries Service Office of Law Enforcement working with the Coast Guard, they can fine you up to $175,000 per day.
Wow. Boo.
So, you know, it's a big time.
Yeah, it is a big time. So, but, you know, there's another thing. And this is what we're talking about is this is really a problem because of the amount of ground that you got to cover. So that's why I guess particularly when you're in international waters, isn't that when a lot of questions come up and say, what are you boarding me for? I'm in international waters. I'm not bound by you.
Yeah, except that the Coast Guard, Office of Law Enforcement, they have jurisdiction over every U.S. vessel.
Mm-hmm.
So they can board any U.S. vessel anytime, anywhere on the planet.
That's U.S. vessels.
U.S. vessels. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But now, under international conventions, mm-hmm. say like the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission, that convention is basically a treaty by nations. There's provisions in there that allow the U.S. Coast Guard to board foreign vessels on the mm-hmm. high seas.
Gotcha.
So these countries have accepted this ability for foreign government vessels that has to be properly marked as an inspection mm-hmm. vessel with flying a flag.
Sure, also, sure.
And follow a certain procedure. But they can board, U.S. Coast Guard can board a Chinese vessel out on the high seas
mm-hmm.
If it's fishing.
Let me ask you this. Are the majority of problems fishing in the wrong waters? I mean, in other words, when you say enforcing,
yeah.
when the Coast Guard sees a boat that's in a zone that's our zone mm-hmm. and it's deployed gear, it's not supposed to be fishing there, right?
Yeah, I don't think so anymore. I think that used to be a problem, say, in the maybe early 90s, mm-hmm. late 80s, when the exclusive economic zones were first starting to be, you know, accepted around 1980, Law of the Sea Convention. Yeah.
A lot of people claimed ignorance. You know, I didn't know I was in this place.
Oh, yeah. You didn't have the proper, you know, navigation. Yeah. But now that's all changed. I mean, people have equipment, vessels on board, big vessels, you know, have GPS that they know exactly where they are. They have the boundaries overlaid. There are a few incidences of, you know, fishing the line, you know, my gear was over, it was not. But a lot of those days of, you know, foreign vessels incurring, you know, in someone else's EEZ, especially the United States, EEZ is much less and less. But the problem with foreign vessels is, say, following regulations that these international commissions set for catch quotas, proper catch monitoring.
Not necessarily, you know, where they're fishing,
not necessarily
but
where,
what they're taking.
How they're fishing, what gear, how they're monitoring their catch, you know, reporting their catch. That's the biggest.
That's another issue. There are certain areas, and you can explain without going into detail because it take hours. There's some methods and some gear that you can't use in some places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, for instance, around the main Hawaiian Islands, there's no purse seining. There's no netting, you know, of that fashion going on.
That big one, yeah.
So I'm guessing that some of these violations would be gear related, maybe not necessarily quota or size or area relocated, but the wrong gear.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I mean, there's around the main Hawaiian Islands, there's a no longline fishing, you know, prohibition.
And that's for how far out?
It's 50 to 75 nautical miles out, depending on the location of land. 75 on the southern areas of the mains. So,
which should theoretically, for those that are listening that fish well within that, that means that the longliners are not coming into where they're fishing.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
By law.
By law.
Yeah, yeah.
There used to be a seasonal reduction of that in the winter months off of Hilo down to 25 miles and on the northern end. But that rule was amended, and now it's 50 to 75 all year round. And then there's, you know, so yeah, gear is always a problem. With fisheries enforcement. But then the issue is also enforcement, they rely on evidence, you know, so they have to be able to make a case. And it enters into the legal realm and the court system. And it sometimes, you know, it takes a long time for them to actually prosecute and find a violation and get a settlement. But it's critical to fisheries management, and it's part of the process, and that's why the U.S. Coast Guard sits on the council. We regularly have meetings with the NOAA Office of Law Enforcement too.
And we're going to be, by the way, entertaining a special guest who knows a lot about enforcement, Coast Guard wise, soon, maybe even as quickly as next week. But I think some of the main things that should be covered. For instance, right now there's a lot and. One of your other uncles, Roy Morioka, pointed out just last week on the show that fish, unfortunately, they don't have GPS units. They don't know where they are. They're just fish. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is I'm chasing this species, and this species goes over there, and I'm following because I know he's there. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, now I'm in an area where I'm not supposed to be.
That's right.
And because I'm within that limit. You have to know, and there's no excuse for that, right? I mean, it's not forgivable.
It's not forgivable. Yeah. There's very little leeway with, say, fishing in a closed area these days, you know. So let's talk about jurisdiction a little bit. So the state of Hawaii jurisdiction is 0 to 3 nautical miles. Mm-hmm. Outside of 3 nautical miles is federal U.S. exclusive economic zone. So the state of Hawaii, DOCARE, principally enforces and monitors state waters.
Mm-hmm.
They have an ability to also enforce out into the EEZ, out into the federal waters, and on vessels enforcing federal regulations, because they have this thing called a joint enforcement agreement.
Essentially, I only heard a little bit. I'm sure my audience would love to know what that is too.
Essentially, the NOAA Office of Law Enforcement provides money and resources to the local enforcement agencies. So they do this across the country. You know, California Fish and Game, you know, Hawaii DOCARE. They'll give several $100,000 up to $1 million a year for assets, you know, trucks,
stuff,
vessels, personnel, equipment. And also it's an agreement. They have to bill their hours. So they have to show that they are working towards monitoring and enforcing federal regulations. That can be Endangered Species Act, turtle violations, for example, Marine Mammal Protection Act, whale encroachment type of stuff, whale watchers, you know, that kind of thing. But also Magnuson Act, fishery regulations. But the joint enforcement agreement doesn't go two ways. It's only a one-way street.
So
the feds are not enforcing state regulations.
Gotcha.
You know, if they're doing a flyover, say if you're in a BRFA, the one of the BRFAs out in the federal waters or something, or even the state waters, if they're flying over and they see something, you know, they might share that with DOCARE, they might not, but it's not their responsibility. Mm. So it's a one-way street with those joint enforcement agreements.
Yeah, and by the way, it must be, for those of you that have been out there and all of a sudden see a plane overhead or a helicopter drop down to take a look at you, you know that Big Brother, in this case, Noah is taking a look at you.
Yeah, and they do that. I mean, you see those dolphin helicopters flying around, and then there's always, they do fly over to those C-130s, and you'll see them out there. They're flying around Penguin Bank. They're flying, you know.
I don't think people know it. I've had the opportunity to spend some time on my regular program with different guys from the Coast Guard, particularly during military operation time, which is coming up, as you know, again in May. It's the Coast Guard's responsibilities ever since 9/11 and now with all of the additional responsibilities have really grown a lot. So there must be a real good schedule maker in there somewhere, because deploying all those things we call assets must be a full-time job, just knowing where everything is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And hopefully we can get Lieutenant Commander Adam Disk, who represents the Coast Guard, on our council on the show, and he does a lot of that scheduling, and it's intense. And those large cutters you see, they're like over 300 feet long.
Oh, huge.
You'll see
we just got a new one, by the way.
You'll see them
cool,
in Honolulu Harbor. Yeah, those very large ones are often not even involved in fisheries enforcement. They're doing mostly drug interdiction off of South America.
Let's do that. That's a whole other slice of this. Yeah. I mean, we know that fishing is dear to all of us in this audience, and we care where you fish, how much you take, what kind of gear you use, when you do your fishing, and all of that. And we also know about the threats to endangered species and everything. But we are also an endangered species. I mean, when we talk about drugs and contraband coming in, that's another whole big different layer that the Coast Guard's involved in.
Absolutely. And then you add in, you know, safety requirements on your vessel, even for small vessels. So, you know, small vessels will get boarded out on the water by the Coast Guard. And now the Coast Guard has, you know, nice new fast patrol vessels. So sometimes they'll wait outside of channel entrances, you know, or harbors, and they'll board you and they'll look for that required equipment. So it is up to you, the vessel owner, to ensure that you are in compliance or you're going to get a fine.
That's one of the reasons why we point people upstairs to life raft and marine safety. When you're driving down the street in a car and you see a thing that says speed limit 35 that you've been told, there's not places out in the ocean whether you can put the signs, but you are supposed to know. It's ignorance is no excuse, right?
And you, you know, there's a list of required safety equipment that you have to have on your boat: EPIRBs, VHF radio, and if you're over a certain size and you're a commercial fishing vessel, you're supposed to have a life raft.
Yep.
And those life rafts are not cheap, and they need to be inspected every year in order for them to pass these sort of qualifications.
Yeah, we've had the guys from Life Raft on a couple of times on how that works. And every now and again, somebody will be retiring from fishing or something, and one will come on the market, and they do inspections of them. And it's not that they're saying, look, if you're going to go out there, if you want us to provide the services which we do, you have to be in compliance with what our rules and regulations are. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing to me, and this comes up a lot, is that there's no charge for that. You know what I mean? I mean, when you get towed in by the Coast Guard, well, I shouldn't say towed in. There are certain charges sometimes for something like that.
Yeah.
But for the greater part, if you've got your ducks in a row, they're all over to help you. But if you don't, I wouldn't expect someday down the line where you say, okay, we had to spend a cutter had to come out there. We spent $300,000 worth. You got to pay us.
Yeah, and there's some instances where if it's not a life threatening situation, they won't tow you in.
Yeah,
so it's you got to find your buddy to come and tow you in. And
they'll take care of you, your body. But if you just run out of fuel and they're 100 miles out, they're going to say, wait a minute, this is not part of the package. You better call somebody.
Right. So the other thing with, you know, enforcement is compliance and voluntary compliance. So it's education and outreach. And, you know, the heavy hand of enforcement is important. But also, you know, my role in enforcement issues is to essentially ensure that the fishing community also is able to access the right regulations, you know, information that allows them to be compliant. Because voluntary compliance is the best, you know, sort of way to not involve heavy-handed enforcement.
Yeah, so, and by the way, further to that, go back just a minute on the vessels. What a lot of people don't know, and we pointed this out, whether you have somebody in the Coast Guard auxiliary at a boat ramp inspect you so you get your sticker, you got all your stuff, you may think, well, that's nice, I'm in compliance. But we also found out with most, if not all, of the insurance carriers, you get a break on your insurance. If they know that your boat is safe and you've got all your gear and you're not fishing in weather conditions that don't cover your particular vessel, you're in good shape with them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's following the regulations, understanding the rules.
Yeah,
understanding the rules is so important. I mean, if you don't understand the rules when you're driving, you're going to get in trouble, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so understanding the rules associated with fishing, you should be fine.
Hey, we have a guy that called the show months ago that had his second BUI, boating under the influence.
Yeah.
You know, where he got pulled over, he was drunk, tried to laugh it off, And as a result of that, he lost his car driver's license.
Oh, really? Wow.
There's a direct umbilical cord, you know. And so there, the consequences aren't to make the Coast Guard or DOCARE or DOBOR or anybody mean. Mm-hmm. It's just to get you to, for your own sake and the sake of others, to take care of business.
Yeah, and if, you know, we recommend if fishermen have a question about a regulation, what they can or can't do, you know, pick up the phone.
Yeah.
You know, call or do some research online. And, you know, the council, I'm happy to take calls on regulations. And if I don't know the answer, I will point you to someone who does. And, you know, I'm not all that familiar with state regulations. There's a lot of them with fishing.
Yeah.
But we can point you in the right direction.
And there's more help to that. We're going to put a save this date in your mind pretty soon for the next Fishers Forum that's coming up. Because at the Fishers Forum, you come in ostensibly to learn about fishing. But the Coast Guard will be there, you know, a different state and federal, I mean state, yeah, and county agencies will be there. It's a pretty good place to bring your question. And I found out one thing. When you go up to one of these desks, there's no such thing as a dumb question. They've heard it all.
They've heard it all. And, you know, they're there to listen to your questions and to provide you the right answer.
You know, you mentioned earlier that there can be some fines which are extremely expensive. Who sets those? How do we determine how serious an infraction is and how the fine should be set?
So when we're talking about federal fishing regulations, there's two entities. So we talked about the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is really the folks on the water with the assets in the air. There's the other entity called the NOAA Office of Law Enforcement. So when there's a fisheries violation of federal regulations, Coast Guard might detect it, but they'll write up a case package, they'll write down the violation, and then they transfer that to the Office of Law Enforcement. The Office of Law Enforcement then proceeds with the case, either gathering more evidence, and then they have lawyers who will, you know, assess the penalty. And that penalty, you know, either you pay it or you contest it. And if you contest it, it goes before a judge. So the schedule for the penalties are set nationally with the federal regulations. They do it every few years, and they've been going up.
Yeah.
You know, but
by the way, I like that. I like knowing that because hopefully I'm not going to be an offender. But secondly is, when you put teeth into something, I mean, most people that see a speed limit sign, they'll kind of look at their speed, and they'll kind of maybe be in compliance. When you see the blue light, that's when we all get pretty compliant. Isn't that a big warning, saying, oh, man, that other boat that did what I did or what I used to do, he lost $200,000.
Yeah, that's the goal of those heavy fines is to deter any future repeat offenders. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes it's a lot of money, and it could break your business. You know, I've seen businesses, you know, fishing businesses go under because they can't pay the fines, they lose insurance, something like that.
It's like they say, though, ignorance is no excuse under the law. Yeah. You can't say, I didn't know.
There's a case on the East Coast right now involving a guy who is basically one of the New Jersey kingpin of the seafood industry. He owned dozens of vessels. I think it's mostly cod. And he's looking at fines of several million dollars.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
wow.
For underreporting.
Yeah, and that shows how serious it is. And by the way, Eric Kingma is international fisheries coordinator, especially for enforcement. And I do know that this audience really appreciates knowing that there are consequences and that they are enforced, because most of these things that we're talking about happen hundreds, if not thousands, of miles away from Hawaii. We don't see them.
Yeah, especially on the international side, the big tuna industrial, you know, fleets like long lines and purse seine. But the one thing about United States fisheries is that our enforcement and monitoring compliance measures are almost unmatched, you know, globally. There's other countries that are pretty good at it, but U.S., we have a significant Coast Guard presence and this whole system of enforcement. But we're on a different playing field, and that sometimes, you know, a lot of times is at disadvantage of U.S. fisheries because we have so many regulations and
we're actually kind of nice, and we allow people all kinds of time to prepare defenses and argue and appeal. Yeah. Eric and I were talking, by the way, Eric, we get together quite often. We're talking just before we came in to do the session today. I was mentioning, I saw this story about there's this one country, I think it's somewhere in Indonesia, I'm not quite sure, but he knows. And there's some enforcement there that's pretty harsh. As a matter of fact, they take your boat out and scuttle it, sink it somewhere. And there's been other cases of they use it for target practice, or they blow the thing up. They're pretty serious about their fishing enforcement.
Yeah, and Indonesia has been changing the way they do business with enforcement, and it's they are trying to set examples, and their example is target practice or setting your boat on fire.
Yeah. I mean, heaven help, that's not going to happen off Pearl Harbor, at least not for the foreseeable future. Right. But it just goes to show you, and this is why we say sometimes, and when you talk magazine and other things that we could talk about, Eric, most people don't understand how much energy it took to get all of these people together and have them agree on anything.
Yeah, I mean, the Magnuson Act is 40 years old now. You know, it's
coming up for a look-see and overall.
Another reauthorization in Congress. So it's taken decades of legislation and energy and people together, working together, even both sides of the political aisle, to develop and have in place this national legislation for fisheries. Other countries have national legislations for fisheries, including how they enforce things, but the United States is in a league of its own.
The other side of that is, and I've heard this expression, that sometimes, depending on these different countries and places, it changes with every, anything that was in yesterday, when the new guy goes in, it's out, and there's no rules for everything. At least here, there's a baton passed, and here's something that's in place, deal with it.
Yeah, you have to enforce it. There's countries where they don't have control of their vessels on the high seas. They don't have it in their legislation that they can enforce their vessels on the high seas. Russia, for example, is a good example of that when they changed over to their new system. They have no control over their vessels on the high seas. Mm-hmm. China, for example, has hundreds of thousands, millions of vessels, I believe, fishing in their coastal waters.
Yeah.
And they have done so much environmental degradation to their nearshore resources. China recently has put in moratoriums, so they can't fish for like months at a time. They've shut down their entire coastal fishery system because they have no other choice. They have no other way to regulate it, to manage it, other than saying you guys are
because
they're in such bad situation.
The good thing is, and we found this, Mother Nature is very forgiving, and with that sort of what we call in Hawaii, if you malama the place, it'll malama you back. So there's, it's more than evidentiary, right? That if you do that, if you are harsh, that things will come back to some kind of normal, maybe.
It'll come back. Yeah. It depends on the type of species, the environment around it, and then the uses around it too. But coral reefs, for example, there's a lot of doomsday talk about coral reefs, but they've come and gone, and they're pretty resilient too. So,
Even with regard to what's that bleaching all of a sudden? Look, it's been going on for centuries, right? And the further down the chain you go, I mean, if you think if you go from the Big Island to Kauai, you can see a tremendous difference in the reefs. You get to Kauai, and even Niihau and places like that, the reefs are skeletons. I mean, they're not holding life anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's important. So when those events do occur, the people that know that area do have to malama. They have to take care, because they are more vulnerable when they are susceptible to in those conditions.
Yeah. You know, gang, there's all kinds of reasons why we want to get in and do this more. And whenever you want to hear something on the show, you can go to wpcouncil.org and see previous shows and learn about events and learn about a ton of stuff. I mean, there's great work going on there. And, of course, you can always drop me an email, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. We'll get on it. One of the reasons why we wanted to get together with Eric Kingma was to make those of you that are rule followers, and maybe you just say, oh, darn it, that's just a little bit too small. If there is no threat of a consequence, or if there's no adherence to rules, nobody make those decisions. We'll be just like China said, you can't do this at all here.
And one thing I'd like to point out, too, is if you guys know of a dumb rule, for example, if there's a regulation that doesn't make sense on the water, let us know. Let people know. Yeah. Fisheries management and regulations are not meant to be, you write them once and you forget about them in some vault and they still apply. It's adaptive management is the way we want to run things, and the regulations should be modified, amended to make sense in current day. So if you guys know of regulations that should be changed, write us a letter.
DoCare particularly.
And with the council, the good thing about the council is, Suzanne Case, chairwoman of DLNR is on the council. Bruce Anderson represents her when she can't be available. So, and so does all the federal agencies, Fish and Wildlife Service, Coast Guard. I mean, they're on the council. So if you have an issue, you can bring it to the council. We'll make sure it gets to the proper agency.
I think one of the things, Eric, today that we might have accomplished, if we didn't, we can try harder to do it again, is to show that there is not, when it comes time to rules and areas and enforcement, where in the past there might have been a them and us. In other words, oh, those are the feds. Don't talk to them. They're feds. I guess every agency has realized, hey, wait a minute. We got all these gray areas in between these overlapping things. We need to work together. And more importantly, the baton's got to get passed in both directions, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, Fish, like you said earlier, they don't follow any political boundaries.
Yeah.
And so
are you a Democrat, Fish? Okay, you can go home today.
Yeah. The federal shutdown today. Yeah,
it was like 8 minutes. By the way, we're recording this on Friday, so we actually could be both out of work, but as for now, it's okay. But, you know, I think there's another example, because that is 12th hour, 11th hour, spooky, spooky stuff. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's happened is, maybe you can explain this, when something becomes a rule or a law or something, it's because somebody thinks they're doing the right thing.
Right.
And if it doesn't work out to be right, I think at least in this area, it can be righted a little bit quicker than in other places.
That's right, because you know, especially if it's a federal rule in the council process, because we're having three meetings a year, public can come down, you know, provide their testimony on anything related to fishing, and if a rule doesn't make sense, boom, right there, we know we have your insight, and we can work on those changes. Other regulations, you know, for example, related to traffic. You know, regulations or violations. It's hard to get those changes done, you know.
Interestingly enough for us, when something happens at the local level and you get a local rep or a senator or councilman or something to get behind it, you can move mountains. Everything moves at a snail's pace in government because there's so many checks and balances, right?
Yeah.
There's all these meetings. But when something happens in Washington that affects a place like Hawaii, you know doggone well, this is not going to be, we're not going to let this be a problem. This is going to be, from the ground up, it's going to be looked at by the council. That must mean that all of you guys in your chairs are more confident in the science being used for things like stock assessments are a lot better than they used to be.
Yes. Oftentimes there's sort of national policies that come down out of D.C. And the one good thing about Magnuson Act and the councils is that they're regional. Mm-hmm. So if you get a national policy that doesn't fit too well for Hawaii, for example, we like to develop our regulations that have more of a regional focus or local basis. And that's the beauty of Magnuson and, you know, the insight that Congress had in developing fish, you know, the Magnuson Act. There's eight regional councils across the country, and they're all different. I mean, they're all fishing, and it's all fishing, but they're all a little bit different how people do things. And
I got one to give you an example. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. There are people that come here from the mainland, and you're going to go fishing, and they say, can I come? I don't have a license, but can I come? You say, what? We don't have a license either. Yeah. There is stronger and stronger evidence now to see that people are understanding that maybe some sort of role's got to be done, whether it's recreational fishing license, part-time commercial fishing license. The only way we can do enforcement is if there's funds, and if there's funds from the people that are the stakeholders, maybe it makes more sense. I'd feel better about it. I don't know about everybody
else. Yeah, I mean, that's the current issue before, you know, DLNR right now is non-commercial fishing licenses and fees associated and how those fees get used. Different arguments on either side, but, you know, we've heard from the scientists. From a science perspective and a man's perspective, if you catch it, you should report it, you know?
Yeah.
And then you get into the issue of, you know, licensing and logbooks and that kind of thing. But on the most basic level, if you want to understand fisheries and how they're doing, how they change over time, stock status, up or down, different environmental conditions, you got to have the good information going in. So you can't go out and count fish too often.
Yeah, and by the way, that's I remember when I was a kid, or when computers first started, they had this, they called it GIGO, garbage in, garbage out, right? And the garbage, we used to put in a lot of garbage, but now the stuff that's going in there is pretty good. And so it's giving workable stats and numbers, and so that's what Eric says. I think that everybody's worried about a tap on the shoulder. Don't most of the other councils that you deal with, are they surprised at how many people in Hawaii sell their fish? They don't just go catch fish. They eat and they sell their fish and they trade their fish?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's other places in the country that there's quite a few sort of expense fishermen, but there is not as many recreational fishermen here. It's more, you know, you sell a little bit to recoup your costs, you give to family, friends, your community. But there are certainly areas of the country where it's purely recreational.
Sure.
You know,
and they're, and they're shocked. As a matter of fact, you cannot go catch a billfish in California and sell it to a restaurant.
Yeah, same with Florida.
You know, yeah, you know, and so you say, what? But and there's another thing, too. We could spend a whole another show on this. We are hoping, and it looks like, we are going to be able to sell marlin on the mainland again and be covered by it. There's, I know it's kind of iffy.
Iffy, yeah.
Yeah, but it they are presenting a good case.
So right now we can.
Yeah.
Right, but there's legislation in Congress
in place,
that would
right, that's what I meant.
Prohibit that. Yeah. And, you know, our marlins, our billfish out here are in healthy condition, with the one exception of striped marlin, Naidagi, is in, not in that great of a place. But that might be changing because they are fairly productive. But, you know, blue marlin is in pretty good shape. Spearfish, the billfish are healthy. And we don't want to see fish that might be spent coming alongside the boat, and you got to throw it back.
Right.
That is, you know, wasteful.
Especially
practice
here in Hawaii.
You know, we don't fish that way. So,
after a long fight with the marlin's pretty done. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, listen, I think that and next week, or the next time we get together with Eric, which is probably going to be next week, we hope to be able to get some of the Coast Guard folks in here to sort of explain that too. And it'd be really neat because I think people want to hear anecdotal stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they want to say, well, we boarded this boat. We were suspecting they were fishing illegally. Turns out they were, and here's what happened.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, good stuff. And by the way, everything you do here on this segment, brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, ends up on the website. We have a nice little logo, and we have some pictures up there. And you can use it for a little schooling if you need. Thanks, Eric. We'll see you again next time.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay, and if you want to hear something on the show, you know the drill, right? TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. Have a great week. We'll see you next time right here. Go fish.